Accession number 18757, Reel 2.
Of course, this was a big problem. Of you had a very narrow corridor to fly down, and you had to pile as many planes into Berlin as you could in that time, in variable weather conditions. I mean, this inevitably, because did the pilot steer on a beacon or something? Is that
there was a beacon, Fraunhofer beacon, which you reported at, and from there you were sent in on whichever runway was in use for that that day, and you were given your put in the pattern for landing.
So did you personally handle this radio traffic? Did you talk to control? Did the pilot talk to control?
Mostly the pilot, unless the weather was bad and he wanted to be free, you know, to handle it himself, then either the WAP usually called up. He had a listening watch all the time. In the Dakota, it was so simple. Switch like that and you could switch into any position in the aircraft. Much simpler than the British aircraft.
And of course you had decent VHF radio by that time.
Yeah. Well, we always had decent VHF radio. It was the ground stations that were lacking a bit, you know, so. But we always had one because of the height. It gave us a big advantage on the range, you see. One of the if I can go back a little while, we were taking some passengers out to Berlin, and I think it was Berlin, and a WAF knocked on the cabin door and said she was a radio operator on 1XB, which was the station that commanded the whole of Germany and most of Europe, France. And I said, yeah, come in. I said, I'm working 1XB now. You can have a chat with your friends if you like. And she came, sat down, put the earphones on, and she was messing about there and nodding her head. So I said, you having trouble? She said, yes. She said, I can't hear them, so I took one side of the earphone. I said, they're calling you now. No, of course I was coming out. No, I can't hear them, she said. It's terrible, she says, all this interference. And so I gave them a call and asked them to wait. And I said, well, they're bang on frequency. I said, you must be able to hear them. But she couldn't read it. And she said, is it always like this? I said, well, yes, you can. So remember, we're at 6,000 feet. We're getting radio signals from all around the world. Down on the ground, all she got was ourselves calling up, you see, on her frequency.
She couldn't short wave.
Yeah, she couldn't hear all these others. Mm. But up in the air, we got them. We had to learn. We were taught, actually, to read through interference, you see. She'd have perhaps 8 stations all on the same frequency. You quite often, over India, you could hear Gloucester. Whereas on the ground at Western, you'd be lucky if you could hear Gloucester. But I could hear it in India at 10,000 feet. And so she was truly amazed. And her parting words when she went, she said, oh, we thought you were a lot of Wallace, she says, up here. Well, I should have a lot more respect for you now.
This was all Morse, was it?
This was Morse, yeah.
Yeah.
Because in addition to the interference you got, the aircraft was often bumping. They were prone to bumping the strongest wind. Not even a strong wind was enough, you know, they'd bump about. And sometimes your hand did stick on the key. You couldn't lift it up because the aircraft had gone down. And your Morse wouldn't be too good at times, I suppose. But she's certainly, and I hope she's spread the word to her friends, I expect she did, that it wasn't quite so easy up in the air as it is on the ground.
So, I mean, what during an actual sortie down a corridor, what radio working did you have to do? I mean, was it purely VHF?
Listening watts most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what were you listening out for?
Instructions.
Uh-huh. Mm. So these would be coming over on VHF or not necessarily? Be on shortwave as well?
Well, we had to have... The rule in the RAF at the time, and a long time after, I think, was any twin-engine aircraft had the carrier radio operator and a listening watch had to be kept, and you had to make contact with the ground by WT, wireless telegraphy, in addition to any other facilities we had. So we had to keep a listening watch. But as I say, I could sit in the second pilot's position, which invariably we did on the airlift, because we didn't carry a second pilot to cut down on the weight. They just carried the navigator, pilot, and WAP.
Engineer or not?
No. Just pilot, navigator, and radio operator. And the radio operator sit in the second pilot's seat and put down the undercarriage and the flap and open up the gills and read off the cylinder head temperatures or any instruments that the pilot couldn't see from his side, which then the second pilot would normally do. Mm. So it was quite interesting. There was plenty to occupy your time.
Now, presumably, when you were flying in that close formation you just told me about, when you came out of cloud, I mean, you didn't stream any aerials out the back. You'd get all caught up in each other's...
Exactly, yeah. Well, we didn't need MFDF then because... Yeah. We didn't need the location positioning finding equipment. You see, we didn't need it. On, yeah. We had our fixed aerial, which was enough for that trip. But
I gather an awful lot of banter went on over the radio.
Oh yeah.
Can you remember any particular instances of it?
The Yanks were best at that. somebody would. There's a very good one I heard, and I can't remember how it went now, but it was to do with, it was an American, in, it was somebody had, we could hear this American talking to his colleague in the front, and he was now and again I'd say something to him, you know, course to steer and what have you, and he'd obviously left his radio on, you see, and someone else called up to tell him, so his colleague had said, what was all that about, and he said, is one of those Lime is, I think they called us. He's obviously, he says, he's left his radio on. He's telling everybody what he's up to. Whereas it was the Yank who'd left his radio on, and an Englishman was trying to tell him that he'd left it on. But this fellow I was flying with, I was with a man called Cook for most of first 6 months, perhaps 9 months. Then I was with a chappie from Bridgewater, strangely enough, he lived. And I've never been able to contact him. I don't know where he's gone.
What was his name?
His name was Richards, warrant officer. And his favourite comment was... We have George in, that's the automatic pilot, you know. And he calls somebody up from the rear, a passenger or one of us, and he'd sit there like this, he said. I don't know, it used to amuse him because he'd done it so often. So look, no hands. Of course, in those days, believe it or not, I expect you've been told before, but there were numerous pilots that couldn't drive a car.
Really?
Any number. Put them in a car and they were lost. They could fly a Lancaster.
Can you tell me a bit, I mean, when you landed in Berlin and unloaded, I presume you just stayed with the aircraft, did you?
Yes, there was. We had some very nice people, ladies, who set up a tea wagon. And you would go there and you would get a free cup of tea or coffee or something.
These German ladies? Or
I don't, can't remember. Remember. Yeah. I think they were probably British, I don't know. I can't remember now. Yeah. I think. But of course they would have German staff if they needed them, so you don't know, really know who. But they looked after us well when we landed. You could have a cigarette and a cup of tea, what have you. While they were loading and unloading.
What was the turnaround like, about 10 minutes? Or I suppose it depended on the cargo, didn't it?
Yeah, if you weren't taking anything back, you could be round in a quarter of an hour. Mm-hmm. And providing there was a... they could get you off, you know, the corridor was empty.
I was going to say, you had to get off with all the stuff coming in as well.
Yeah.
On the same runway, was it?
Yes.
Yeah.
The... just something came to my mind then. Oh yes, we would do the return trip. It was four hours, and we had to have a meal, wash, and if necessary, shave, and do the return trip inside that 4 hours. We had a bit of time to spare. It would take us about the return trip. I think would take us about. 2.5 hours, 2.5 to 3 hours.
Well, from leaving Fassburg to coming back?
To coming back, yeah. Mm. So we were allowed 4 hours for it. So, something else came to mind. It's gone now.
Did you refuel before every sortie? Or?
Yeah, we only carried enough fuel for the
round trip.
Trip. Yeah, so that you had to refuel every trip, yeah. Yes. Carried no extra weight at all.
Were there any unusual loads you took in on your Dakotas?
No, basically it was... can't recall any. Coal and food.
Did you encounter the Soviet fighters at all?
No. Oh, yeah, we've seen them occasionally, yeah. We were always on the lookout for them, actually. And I think we were briefed to stick to our course, make sure we were in the corridor and not provoke them. But there was a little... we had one... pilot, I remember. I won't mention his name, but he used to, as you took off from Gatow, you flew over the Russian zone of Berlin, and he used to empty all the rubbish you could lay his hands on out the window. Whether it ever upset anyone, I don't know, but there used to often be a lemonade bottle amongst it.
Yeah. Did your aircraft ever go unserviceable in Berlin, or were you stranded there at all?
No, only once, and I can't recall what it was all about, but I think it could have been the aircraft unserviceable, because an American took us to lunch in the town, in Berlin itself. He drove us down there, and he took us to his flat. He plied us with beer and chocolate and cigarettes and brought us back again. It was one of the American ground officers at Gatow. That was the only time, and I think it was only for a few hours.
So that's the only time you saw anything of the city? The
only time we ever set foot in it.
Yeah.
Went to, on the reunion this year, I went to Berlin, last June, and we went to Gatow, and that was the second time I'd set foot outside the airfield, Gatow in Berlin.
You got quite a welcome, I believe, didn't you, on that trip?
Oh, it was very good, it was fantastic, yeah. But, for me, and I think it was 10 others, the first day was too much. We packed in at 8 o'clock, but the rest of them went on until early hours of the morning. So but we'd had enough at 8 o'clock and got a taxi and came back to the hotel.
Mm-hmm. Now tell me, how long did you come home on home leave during the airlift? Did you work a certain number of weeks or what?
Yeah, your aircraft needed servicing, and you brought it back to England for servicing, and you had a few days off while it was being serviced, usually about 3 days, I think, 3 or 4 days, and you took it back out again.
So they reckon that an aircraft fatigue life was the same as its crew, so you
Yeah.
Where did you come back to? Netherhaven or Lynham or...?
Well, invariably, they were very good in the RAF, you see. Very good. If we did come back to an awkward station, we came back to Netherhaven usually, but sometimes we didn't. And they would lay on an aircraft and take us to Netherhaven. They'd lay on an Anson or an Oxford or something and take us to Netherhaven. So as we had our, if we were living out, I wasn't, but some chaps were, you were brought back to your home station. The RAF were very, very good on that. And I know one thing I'd like to ask you. On the ground staff at Gatow or Fazbear, there was a very badly disfigured RAF flight lieutenant, I think it was. Did you ever come across him?
No, I've never heard of him.
I think he must have been a fighter pilot shot down, or he was very badly disfigured, his face. He was always on duty, that's why I wondered if
you'd come across him. I haven't come across him at all, I'm afraid, no. So, I presume you're applying, what, 4 sorties a day?
No, we're scheduled to do 4.
Yeah.
I've looked at my logbook, and we invariably only done 3.
And this is over a period of how many weeks?
This was over 12 months I was on it.
12 months, but I mean, what sort of, how many breaks did you have in that 12 months when the aircraft had to come back? Was it regularly every 3 weeks or so?
Oh no, it wasn't regular. It was about once a month, I suppose. If that, probably once every 6 weeks, because I...
Because it was very tiring flying, wasn't it? I mean, it was round and round and round, flying very accurately.
Yeah, and as I say, it was a 20-hour day. You sometimes had 3 breakfasts on the trot. Breakfasts started at midnight. And you'd done 3 trips by 10 o'clock, we'll say, in the morning. So you had 3 breakfasts. Each time you landed, you had a breakfast. And then another time, it would be 3 roast beefs or what have you, because of the...
And you were still with, what, 271 Squadron at this time?
No. I was with Netherhaven, which was 1333 Transport Support Unit. and we were attached to 77 Squadron. And during the week, there was a notice on, I don't know if you ever see it on TV, the, call it, troops on Channel 4. Service Pals. Do you ever watch it?
No, I haven't, no. On Channel 4?
Yes. And there was 77 Squadron, and I seen it, and I was just about to read it, and the system broke down.
Oh, dear.
And there was change this week now, today. It's changed, so I've lost it. I can't see what it was about 77 Squadron.
Phone up Channel 4 and find out. Phone up Channel 4.
Do you think they'd tell me?
Yeah, I'm sure they would. Remember the date. Anyhow, you were, what, the best part of a year then, flying from these various aerodromes.
Yes.
Not only Fassberg, but Lübeck.
Lübeck and Wunsdorf.
Yeah. And you can remember the time when it all finished, can you?
No, I came out just before it finished. I'd already been due out.
Came out the RAF?
Yes. I was due for DMOB, and each time I came back on to Netherhaven, the CO would say, well, what do you think? You can go out if you want to, or you can stay in until it's finished. And I, each time I stayed in, and I suppose I was about 12 months overdue on my DMOB when I finally came out.
What were you in for, 5 years or something?
No, I was only in for the normal duration, but I had 5 years in the volunteer reserve to do, because I was a VR. So I had 5 years, so I could I was never pushed. I must honestly say that in the RAF I was treated very well. I can't, I couldn't find any cause for complaint. At the end of my 5 years, which was up in 1954, they gave me a trip to Singapore, supernumerary crew. I'd been out of the RAF 5 years then. So,
so what did you come out as?
Radio operator, warrant officer.
Warrant officer, yeah. And what job did you go to in Civvy Street after that? In the same line of business? Or?
Strangely enough, yes. I worked at Western Airport.
Oh, really?
And from there I got posted to Roos Airport. And then my first wife was very ill over there. And she went to Ham Green Hospital. So I came back to Western and I had nothing. So I set up my own little business in Meadow Street, electrical.
What are you, going back to the airlift, what are your sort of main memories? I mean, were you conscious at the time that it was a very historical moment, or was it just an everyday job?
No, we always thought that it would become too expensive for the countries concerned, and it would come to a halt. But it didn't work out that way. The came to a halt, but not for that reason. I think to an extent we enjoyed it. It was certainly better than dropping paratroopers on Salisbury Plain. And much more interesting. But it was getting dicey in that bad weather. The I lost a very good friend. He was killed. And another crew that I knew well all finished up in hospital. And I think possibly after 12 months we were getting tired.
When you said just now that you thought that there wouldn't be the money to keep it going, I mean, did you think that in fact the Russians would succeed in the end in their blockade?
In a way, yes, I suppose we did. We thought that we would have to pack up rather than pack it in. But
even though once it got into its stride, it was carrying virtually everything, wasn't it?
Yes, the... another thing at Gatow was used to annoy me and annoyed a lot of crews, I'm sure. Well, I know it did. Was you landed there during the day, and there were all sorts of things, people there to meet you. Film stars, they were there. There's all sort of publicity for everything. All sorts of people appeared during the day. When you went at night, the only person you've seen apart from the unloaders was this dear woman in her canteen making tea for us. But during the day, that airfield was packed with Indian people. How it went on during the night without them, I don't know, but it did. Oh, I remember that. It used to be all sorts.
What were they brought in for? Propaganda reasons or what?
Well, newspapers used to be full of it. Yeah, it was all for propaganda, yeah. I suppose. I don't know, but they were all there during the day, but at night.
Did you operate into any American airfields temporarily? Or?
Occasionally you went into. Oh dear, not Teagle, that was the French Teagle.
Templehof,
yeah. Occasionally went in there, yeah. But it was the same. The only good thing about Templehof was we used to try and get a meal there because without going up to the servery, you could have fresh milk and all sorts, which we never got one. It was all powdered milk. Whatever. The Yanks had all the food in the world. And we'd go in there and we'd pick up fruit, apples and milk and whatever, just without going to the servery, just off of the side tables, you know. So we always pretended to be hungry when we went into Templehof and got ourselves into the mess. Brought back a few odds and ends. Sometimes they'd sell you some chocolate and stuff like that. Mm. And the PX or PBX or PX, yeah. I think it was called.
Well, Lenny, I think I've exhausted my questions, unless you can think of anything, any other incidents at that time. I mean, shall I stop the machine a minute?
Yes, I'll do it quickly.